Sorry, what's the delay? So I think we should start. Hello and welcome to the tutorial on critical systems development with UML and model-based testing. I'm Jan Jürgens from the Technical University of Munich, and I will present this tutorial based on work we have undertaken in Munich together with other people in the UMethic group. So firstly, I would like to start off with some motivation. This talk will be about critical systems development in different kinds of senses. So I will firstly talk a bit about safety critical or dependable systems, and in the second part of the talk, more on security critical systems. And also I will mention some topics about real-time systems. And in all of these application areas, we have the same situation that the development of critical systems to a high standard of quality is not easy. And we see that with many examples in practice that there are actually problems. So there are, especially in the security area, there's a lot of media attention over the last couple of years with failures and flaws in security critical software, often related to viruses or website weaknesses and so on. But also in safety critical systems we have, well, unfortunately, quite a few spectacular incidents in the past where software-based critical systems have failed. And one example for that is the Ariane rocket and the explosion of the Ariane rocket in the late 90s, which was related to software failure. And so these are just a few examples for the problems that we have in this area. And the problem is that which you always have to face in this kind of situation is that the quality of the software that is being developed is always in conflict with the cost of the development. And if you work in industry, you will be aware of the fact that software development is always it's always taking place in an environment where you have to consider the costs of your systems. And the problem is that, of course, if you try to save too much money in development and thereby you include failures, then in the long run you will actually have to pay more, because you may have to pay for the damage caused by these failures. The problem is that it's not easy to convince, for example, the management of these the situation, because this is really something you would only have to be able to argue by talking about the long run, and that's always it's always difficult to do to predict the future of your software systems. So that's why you always have this problem that you have to at least you have to take into consideration the cost of the software that is being developed. And therefore it's that's where really the problem starts with developing critical software in practice. Because if you had an unbounded resources in time and money, then one should think that it would be possible to construct systems that are that are as high quality as you would like them to be. But this is not the situation in practice, of course. So you always have to see that you make the best use of your available resources. And well, this is maybe one of the motivations for the kind of work that I'm presenting here, because of course the problem that the problem of developing critical systems is of course an old one, and there has been a lot of research done towards improving the quality of developed critical software. But the problem is that often, if this is done in an academic environment, then people focus more on the well, the academically interesting things rather than thinking about how to get the results work in practice. So specifically, I am referring here to a lot of work done in formal methods, or rather done towards improving formal methods. And of course, formal methods were proposed also specifically to increase the quality of software to be used in a critical environment. But the problem is that formal methods have not really been put into so much use in mainstream industrial development, apart from very specific situations. And so the motivation here is that this is really the starting point of this work, the situation where, in principle, you have sound methods in terms of formal methods for developing critical systems and for verifying properties of your system for your criticality requirements, but so far this is not in such a widespread use in industry. And so this was the motivation for this kind of work, and I will try to argue why we think that this approach may help in that respect. So firstly, introducing the idea that is used in the approach here, that could be seen under the slogan of model-based development, where quite generally, one could say that the trend in computer science or software engineering is maybe to allow humans to write their systems as close in a way which is as close to their natural ideas as possible. So in the beginning of the use of computers, people actually had to write the code in machine language. Then people introduced assembler, then higher level languages such as Basic, Pascal, and so on. And the trend is generally to get closer to the way that humans actually think, as opposed to the way that machines work. But of course, there's a gap which you have to bridge between the way digital computers work and the way the human mind works. And this is the general framework for this idea of model-based development, where the idea is that firstly, you are given a set of requirements which arise from your specific situation of the system that you would like to construct, and from these requirements and from maybe also from the information about the environment of the system that you have, you then build models which at that point should be as intuitive and as easy to construct and to understand as possible. So at this point, you should not have to worry about constructing your models in a way that the code later runs as efficient as possible or something like that. And then in the next step, the idea is that you would go actually to code that could be executed on a given machine to fulfill the requirements on the code, even with respect to performance and so on. And well, how to actually get from requirements via models down to code, presumably the first step is always a manual one, because you, well, you firstly had to get the requirements into something which you could at least draw using some kind of editor or write or whatever with. And the second step from models to code, there are several possibilities. Either you can take the models and then manually construct the code, given the models, and later produce test sequences from the models to test that the code actually does what the models specified. Another possibility would be to actually automatically generate the code from the model, and this is at this point possible to some extent in certain situations, but I think that at this point it does not work perfectly. But there may be the possibility that at some point you can actually do this automatically, at least in specific situations. But of course, when writing code, as I said earlier, when you construct the model, you should not have to worry about things like performance and things like that. So if of course you have to worry about that in a lot of situations when the code is written. So if this should be done automatically, the step from models to code, then somehow this this clever engineering of the code for performance aspects would need to be automated in order to be able to produce, to mechanically produce code. And this is, I guess, current work at this point. But yeah, these are, you could say, the two principled alternatives. Either write the code manually or generate test sequences, or generate the code directly. So, and now in the context of this model-based development, which by the way is not our invention, but you could say that in some way the traditional formal methods approach goes in that direction, or is at least similar in the idea to the model-based approach, although usually you would not consider generating code directly from formal specifications. At least, I'm not aware of a lot of work which has done that. But in principle, it's the same kind of idea. And but more specifically, this this idea of model-based development has been put forward by the Object Management Group, which is the industry consortium which actually standardized UML, which is what I'm using in this talk, as you know. But before I come to UML, firstly, I don't start right away with UML, because I'm trying to make the point that so far this is really independent of UML as a notation. I'm using UML here in this talk because it has received a lot of attention and many people know UML, but the general approach is really independent of the notation that you're using. The second idea here is that using this model-based approach, you would then like to consider the criticality properties of your system. So this could be safety critical, security critical, and so on. The point is that you consider them from early on in the system development, and this is actually what, unfortunately, in many cases is not what's being done in practice. And specifically in the security area, you often have the situation that people start constructing the system, and their first worry is that, well, the first question is whether what the product they are producing will actually be sold at all. And the second question is whether they will be the first to produce this product rather than their competitors in order to be able to sell it. And then, of course, it should also be produced as cost efficient as possible in order to make a profit in the end. So, and these are the three reasons really why security, for example, in practice, unfortunately, often comes last. Because, of course, if you don't yet, if you're not yet sure whether you will be fast enough and cheap enough, and whether someone will buy your product anyway, then you may be tempted to postpone the questions about whether it will be secure. And that's the situation, I think, in many cases so far. I mean, you most prominently you see that with also with popular operating systems. But I mean, the point is really that there are reasons why the situation is so. I mean, it's not that whoever writes the software would not be able to produce secure software, but there are commercial constraints why things happen the way they are at the moment. And well, I suppose in safety critical systems the situation is a bit different, because since the people are aware of the problems there for a longer time, and specifically because often there's actually a human life at stake in this kind of software. And because of that, you already have you have regulations which people have to follow in order to construct the software. But as I mentioned already, still we still have problems in that area as well. So the point now is that if possible, it would be of course better to consider your criticality properties from early on in the development cycle. And why would it be better? There are several reasons. So one reason is, for example, that the later you have to change parts of your system, the more expensive it will be. And I mean, there's a lot of this is really a well-known fact for a long time. I think Böhm already stated this fact that that of course, if you have to change or if you have to correct flaws in your system at the time where you already have the running code, then it will be more costly to correct the flaws, as opposed to be able to doing this while you're still writing the specification. Of course, assuming that the flaw are already, or that the flaws are already apparent in the specification, which of course is not always the case. But with many examples, and I will show some examples in the next couple of slides, you actually have the situation that there were flaws in running systems which you could have detected on the specification level, and in this way you could really save a lot of money and time by doing it this way. So that's why the idea is to consider the criticality properties from early on in the development process, and also within the development context, because this also helps you to actually find the mistakes, and not to for some properties you even need to take into account things like properties of the physical environment of your system. For example, if you have different components that communicate through certain communication links, then you need to know the physical properties of these communication links to be able to judge whether the communication will satisfy your criticality requirements, or whether you have to introduce a specific protocol such as a fault tolerance protocol or something. This is why you need to why it's beneficial to actually consider it within the development context and not just say from early on, okay, I have these requirements and I want them to be fulfilled, and then you know, not stop worrying about that until you actually have the system and then start to try to verify the properties. So that would not be such a good idea. And well, the point of about taking this expensive view is also what I just said already, that you all often have to take into account all kinds of properties about your system, such as the physical environment, or also, of course, importantly, the way that the software is supposed to be used by the human user in the end, because that's always also where many problems show up. And that's why it's also, well, depending on your actual system, it's useful to be able to model something like the business process, which should be supported by the system that is going to be constructed. And all of that should be, you should be able to put together all of this information and then analyze for your critical requirements. And then about how to do this analysis. Once you have formulated all this information and you know what your critical requirements are, then of course in principle you could try to establish whether your models satisfy the requirements by inspecting the models and, you know, looking at them. And this may work for many requirements which are not somehow connected to very difficult behavioral properties of the system. But of course, by manual inspection, you may always miss something, even if the requirements are really straightforward, and you could, in principle, verify them by hand. There's always the risk that you miss some property just by mistake, because it can be quite a tedious task to do, and that's why, of course, it would be good to have tool support for this. So this is why I mean, more specifically by model analysis, that this should be preferably be done by in a tool-supported way, and of course also as far as possible automatically. And this is maybe also if we have in the back of our mind this background of the formal methods approach, which is one of the reasons maybe why many of the formal methods have not been so successful, is that, or at least some of them actually require quite a lot of human interaction and quite a lot of knowledge about the formal methods and about mathematics and logic and so on, and which is not always present in a given development context. And of course would be quite expensive if you have to sort of buy this for your project, if you have need to buy an external consultant for that. And then the next step, in a way, if we look at this process, constructing models from requirements and then constructing the code, of course it's not enough to check that your model is actually fulfills the requirements, but the next step you also have to check that the code, unless you actually generate code automatically, which as I said is at this point not always possible, if you do it manually somehow, then you still have to check that the code actually does what the requirements say. And there's a second thing about this: you may also have to check whether there are not new flaws introduced which were not apparent on the model level, but I will say a bit about that later. So this is really what I said on the last slide. Firstly, you need to analyze your models against the requirements, and secondly, you need to get from models to code, or either via code generation or manually, and then use test generation. Okay, and as I said, this really this approach, and in general, you could use with any kind of notation, really. Presumably, it should be easy to use. And now, why I'm using UML here in this presentation is that there are some advantages connected with UML. Firstly, there are a lot of people already know the unified modeling language already. This is it has been standardized in 96 by the Object Management Group, and it actually builds on several major object-oriented development methods, which before 96 were separate, and you know, before that day, there were really quite a few competing notations and approaches for developing specifically object-oriented systems. But as it happened, three of them in 96 were joined together, and this this seemed to have enough momentum so that they actually this industry consortium, the Object Management Group, which consists of really some major players in the software development field, they got together and now standardized this notation for developing object-oriented systems. And of course, originally this was done for object-oriented systems, but as we will see, it's also possible to use the approach for systems which are not necessarily object-oriented. And there you could do this by using a component-oriented approach, which is also possible if you don't use object-oriented languages, and there you gain in a way instead of considering objects as the smallest part in any system, you consider components. And this is for what I'm saying today, this is really the ideas of using objects or components are really rather exchangeable. And you could even say that objects maybe are in some situations too small or too fine-grained so that you won't always want to consider objects anyway. Even if you use object-oriented languages, it's often almost necessary to also consider the component level. In that sense, it's not really so much of a difference whether you use objects or not in, for this approach that I'm presenting here. Firstly, many people know UML, and secondly, compared to earlier notations with a comparable level of knowledge in practice, UML is relatively precisely defined. And when I say comparable to other notations, I mean, for example, these object-oriented notations and methodologies that existed before UML was standardized. Of course, it's only relatively precisely defined. And I will say a bit more about that because the meaning of the diagrams in the official document which defines UML is formulated in prose. It is formulated as precise as you can be when using English language as opposed to formulas for defining the meaning. And this sometimes, if you actually want to do verification, it's not quite precise enough, so you need to use a more formal or mathematical model for the semantics of UML diagrams, and Of course, since this does not officially exist at this point, there is some kind of gap between the use of UML, which is probably most prevalent in industry, and the use of UML that you may want to use in this approach and when considering critical systems, because here you have to be a bit more precise if you actually want to use tool-supported verification of critical behavior properties. But the point here is really that the gap between these two different uses of UML is not as big as if you had to learn a complete new notation, such as a formal message or something like that. And lastly, the reason or because UML is so well known and also used quite a lot in industrial development, there are already many tools for UML. So firstly, it started with tools just for drawing the diagrams, and there you actually have quite a few tools. Some of them, they actually exist even tools which are quite good and even freely available. So at the level of constructing UML specifications in terms of drawing diagrams, the situation is really satisfactory. And then if you want to use, if you want to do an analysis of the models, there you don't have so many tools yet, but the situation is improving there also. So there are quite a lot of tools which are developed at the moment at universities and also at research labs in industry, which would support the analysis of models or test sequence generation or simulation and transformation and so on. So at that point, this is also an advantage in using UML. Now if you decide that you want to use UML for developing your critical systems, then firstly you have to consider whether you have to adapt the notation or whether it would be useful to adapt the notation to your specific application domain where you want to develop your system. Secondly, the question is how to use UML correctly in this application domain. And I already mentioned this conflict between the more informal use of UML, which is of course more flexible and may also be just convenient, and the requirements on preciseness you have on your models if you actually want to perform tool-supported analysis. And regarding to tool support, as I mentioned on the previous slide, there are many tools already for the basic things such as drawing diagrams, but as I said already, when it comes to analyzing models and so on, this is still ongoing work. So in this tutorial, I would now like to give a background on, firstly, on using UML for critical systems development, and also on, in a way you could say, on from two points of view of people who might be interested. Firstly, say what is possible for the user at this point already, and secondly, how one would have to proceed if one wanted to extend UML oneself, and if one wanted to do research oneself on how to further extend the UML or on how to construct tool support for UML and so on. So I guess there are these two points of view why one could be interested in this tutorial. And more specifically, I will firstly start with giving some basics about the unified modeling language, and specifically about how to define extensions of the UML, and secondly say a bit about what extensions exist already. Although in each case I can only give a or present a fragment of the extensions, because the problem is always that if you want to extend UML by including all kinds of features that may be relevant for a given application domain, then this could end up being, if you really want to do this completely, then of course you would have to include a lot of material, because in principle you have to take a given book on your application domain, say on safety critical or security critical systems, and try to include at least the main information into the UML modeling language and into extensions of the notation. And of course it's not possible to present this in this tutorial. And so I will in each case only focus on or explain a fragment of these extensions, and the focus is here more on showing how to extend the notation and how the extension works under the hood of the approach, in a way on the level where you would be able to construct full support. So some of what I'm saying today will not actually be necessary for someone to know who just wants to use the different extensions, but more useful for someone who wants to define extensions himself, or who wants to construct full support. And so in a way, as I mentioned already, what I'm doing here is to use UML as a bit more formal design technique than as it is used in, on a very widespread way in industry. And I will explain what this means exactly. And then I also included a bit about model-based testing and more generally about tools for this approach. And I can also give a demonstration about, demonstration of one tool that we have been developing in Munich. And I will also talk a bit about some case studies for this approach. And as I said already, I will on the one hand focus on safety critical, but also on security critical systems. And yeah, so this is the overview. Are there any questions at this point? I think I have not said already, but of course if you have any questions, then please say them immediately, so we can have a sort of interactive tutorial. Yes, and depending on time, it would probably be nice if we, in the end, we could also have some a bit more interactive part of the tutorial, because depending on what you are looking for, but it may not be very easy to follow and to actually follow a full day talk by just me standing here and presenting, which I could do if you like, but we'll see how we do in the afternoon. Okay.
I could ask you one thing. Mm-hmm. I've often wondered when people use this phrase "formal design technique." Mm-hmm. Does it really mean based on mathematics?
Yes, in this case it does actually, yes. But of course you are right that formal is often used, and depending on where or who says it, it has a lot of meanings. So if you say it, if someone from the formal methods community, from academia says it, then they actually mean based on mathematics, on logical formulas. But of course if people who don't have a background sometimes use it just to say that it's more formal than what other people are doing. Just to answer the question, I actually mean formal here. The only what I'm trying to do here is to be formal under the hood in a way, you know, under not on the surface of the approach, you know, to allow people to use the UML notation, which on the surface is just a couple of diagrams, but to have a sort of execution semantics, which is actually formally defined. So I have defined a formal semantics for a simplified fragment of UML based on previous work and the formal methods community. And there has actually been quite a lot of work on defining formal models or formal semantics for parts of UML. And that is what I'm trying to use here. But of course, at least to me, I think it seems to be apparent that UML is quite a big and complicated language. So if you want to base it on something which is actually mathematically formal, then you can only consider a simplified fragment. And this is what I'm doing today. But for this fragment, the intention is that it is actually formal. And specifically, this means that while defining this formal semantics, which I will say a bit more about in later slides, using this formal method, abstract state machines, which was proposed by Gurevich a couple of years ago. And based on that, we constructed some tool support which allows you to check critical requirements of the UML models. So that's the connection between the formal foundation and the actual use of this approach. That answers the question. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing you said related to, you know, having the mathematics under the hood.
Yes.
And using some kind of, you know, simplified notation.
Yes, so that's really the motivation of this work, as opposed to maybe formal methods or the traditional formal methods approach. Yeah. But
we have that in formal methods as well.
Okay. Yes, I mean, depending on what your focus is. Yes, I mean, I'm just trying to say that maybe in the beginning of formal methods, people focused more on, constructing tool support for verifying logical formulas and so on. And for some time, I had the impression that they did not worry so much about who was going to use it in industry. And this is the motivation here, to try to use UML in a way. If you look at it from the point of view of formal methods, use UML to transport the ideas and results from formal methods to industry by making use of this notation, which is used in industry. Okay. So since we have a bit of discussion, it may be interesting for me or also for helpful for you if you could maybe give me a short background about what your own background is. Is it, so how many people here are from industry? Maybe you could raise your hand. And from academia? And there are some people who are undecided.
Okay.
Okay, so, yes. So this is industrial research. Okay, so sort of in between, if you like. Okay. How many here are interested more in safety critical systems and security? Okay. So yeah, I will. I will actually start with safety critical systems, and then, but also say a bit about security. I guess we have enough time today. So, background on UML. How much do you know about UML already? So, who knows a little bit about UML, and who is an expert? Okay, so yeah, I'll try to sort of stay in the middle ground here. So we would then proceed with giving a short introduction into the parts of UML that I'm using here in this tutorial. And actually, I think we have a coffee break at 11 o'clock, which we should try not to forget. Okay, so yeah, starting with UML. So I think probably everyone has seen UML or heard about it. So the Unified Modeling Language, as I mentioned earlier, which was standardized by the OMG in 96. And so most obviously it's a visual modeling language originally for object-oriented systems, but as I said already, you can also use it for component-oriented approaches. And visual meaning that you have different kinds of diagrams which allow you to specify different views on the system. And the views include, for example, the data structure of the system, which could be the class structure in the case of object-oriented systems. And secondly, the physical environment of the system, and also the behavior of your different components in the system. So this is really, and also you can specify things like business processes or the use cases, the way that your system is actually going to be used by human users. And this is probably everything you would want to know about your system. Given that you can also include specific information about how it is going to be used and how it's going to be performed. So you can include constraints, or you can include timing information and so on. So it's not just about what the system does, but you can also specify how the system does it. And you can also use different kinds of levels of abstractions for modeling your system. And for example, if you just want to specify the data structure of the system, then this allows you to stay on a higher level of abstraction than if you actually want to specify the behavior of certain parts of the system. And I mentioned already that it's by now probably the de facto industry standard in object-oriented modeling, if not even just in modeling software-based systems on the whole. I don't actually have the actual figures, but it is claimed by the OMG anyway. Of course, you have to take that with a grain of salt, maybe. But what they say is that I think in software development, in 5% of the cases, modeling is actually used. And of those cases, in the vast majority of the cases, people then use UML. As I said, I don't have the actual figures there, but it could be possible that this is true. But, of course, you can then also notice that, or you might think that, 5% is not really so much. So presumably there would be still some scope in actually using more of modeling. But then, on the other hand, if you... In many systems, you don't actually have the motivation, at least not for the work that I'm presenting here, because, of course, most systems are not safety or security critical, and there you may just want to hack up your code as quickly as possible without having to worry about too many critical requirements. But, of course, modeling, in a way, I mean, there are also still some problems with modeling which you have to consider, just to mention them. I mean, it's not that I'm trying to say that just by using modeling all of the problems will go away and this will be perfectly simple and easy, but so one of the problems you sometimes have in practice is that people construct a model and then they have to construct the code by hand because code generation is somehow not available for the given target. And the problem is that after this is done, they realize they have to change something about the system. But then, although they started by using models, because they wanted to do it in a sound way, it turns out that when they had to do the modifications, they didn't have enough time to then also modify the UML models. And in the end, we end up having UML models which are sort of outdated and which do not actually correspond to the running system anymore. And of course, at that point, you lose the benefit of using the model-based approach because you may introduce new mistakes which you cannot find on the model level simply because it's not up to date. So this situation where you have this separate model and code level, and you don't have an automatic way between going back and forth between them, this you may run into problems there. But as I said, I think the situation is improving, at least in either way. Of course, another possibility would be to have an automatic generation of UML models out of your code, and there is also actually some work being done on tools doing it this way. And in that way, you make sure that if you change your code, this will be reflected on the model level and thereby also on the documentation. So it's not a complete problem, but it's something you have to consider when thinking about using this approach. And lastly, something which is especially useful if you want to use UML in a specific application domain, such as safety or security critical systems, is that you can actually extend UML in an officially defined way. And this is something that from early on, the people who designed the UML already took into consideration that you might want to extend UML for a specific application domain, and therefore you have these standard extension mechanisms such as stereotypes, and I will explain in more detail how they work exactly. Related to that, some people even say that UML is not just a notation or language, but it's more a family of languages. And the point there is that, firstly, UML is big enough as it is, as I mentioned already. Firstly, because of historic reasons, because it was created from unification of several earlier approaches. So you could say somehow, jokingly, that people just put together everything they had in one big bowl and stirred it a bit and then had this new notation. So this means that there are a lot of different diagram elements. Some of them you can actually use interchangeably, and then you have to make sure that the notation or the model actually stays consistent. And also in each of the diagrams you have quite a lot of features for different kinds of things you would like to capture about your system. So this makes the UML quite a big language to start with. I think the official definition document has several hundred pages, I think I forget the actual current numbers, maybe 500 pages or something like that. And this is quite dense text, and you probably would not want to read it in one go on a Sunday afternoon or something. So it is big already, and that's why it actually makes sense to say that it's in a way a family of languages, so that the hope would be that one day you have an officially defined core of UML which everyone would want to use, and then different extensions in different ways. Firstly, for these all kinds of different features about what you would like to model, and secondly, about the different application domains. But these different standardizations, extensions, and so on are really also still in progress. So the current situation is that in March, the version 1.5 of the UML was officially adopted, and but at the same time, there has been for quite some time the standardization development process for the 2.0 version of UML in progress already. And this is now actually converging on one proposal. So the way this always works in the OMG is that people start out by issuing requests for proposals for maybe a new version of UML or an extension of UML for a specific application domain. And this happened, I think, a couple of years ago already for UML 2.0. And by now, people somehow have converged to actually one proposal after initially there were a couple of them. And this is now being adopted. So the official adaptation will actually still take some time. And it's not clear whether it will still take place this year. But it looks as if it's, it seems to be clear in what direction things will be going. And even to the extent that some UML tools already say that they support UML 2.0, of course, they may then have to do some adjustments with some details if things manage to change. But anyway, and I think the first books about UML 2.0 are supposed to come out this fall or something. Officially it will still take some time. So there's always the process is a bit chaotic. Always, you know, there are some people saying that they are able to publish something about it already, although it officially does not exist yet. But of course, to be fair, you should say that it exists more or less at this point. But I mean, it's maybe the backside of having such a well adopted notation with so many people in industry involved is that it takes a lot of time. And of course, at some point there are even by now commercial assets or commercial stakes involved. If you have a certain modeling tool which supports one thing or another, or which could be easily extended in that or some other direction, then you can imagine that there may be strong opinions about what to do with UML and in which direction to go. So, you would probably seen a bit of UML already. So how does it look like? As I said already, it consists of different kinds of diagrams which allow you to specify different parts of your system. And here just show a couple of them on the slide to see how it looks like. And as I said already, also in this talk and more generally in the approach, we're just using a fragment of UML, meaning that firstly we're just using some of the diagrams, and more importantly maybe in each case only use a simplified version of the diagrams. And again, the reason for that is to be able to use it together with tool support which we have been constructing for the approach. Of course, if you don't want to use this tool support, which is, as I said, based on this mathematical definition of the execution semantics of UML, then of course you can also use the other parts of UML, which I'm not using in this approach. But of course you then will not get the benefit of having an automatic analysis of the model for your criticality requirements. So there's, there's a sort of trade-off between the highest flexibility and expressibility of your notation and the support in terms of analysis. So firstly, the first kind of diagram we're using here in this approach is the activity diagram, and this allows you to specify the flow of control between different system components. And well, this could be well, not only system components, but maybe other systems which with which your system should interact, so the environment or even human users. So you can also use activity diagrams to specify business processes, for example. This is why some business process specification tools actually use annotation which is very similar to activity diagrams. Although this is really a different community, you could say, process engineering as opposed to software engineering, you also get a link to that setting via this notation. Secondly, the class diagrams, and these allow you to specify the data structure of your system. So that already, if you use object-oriented systems, then these actually specify the different classes in the system. If you don't use objects, then you can still use class diagrams, and then each class model will represent one component of your system, and you can still specify which data is used in the component, or at least the more important data that is used there, and you can also specify then how or to which interfaces the component will be used by the environment of the component. Only, of course, if you're not using object-oriented systems, then you will not use things like inheritance and so on. These things actually in this presentation I will not focus so much on anyway, because inheritance is sort of orthogonal to what I'm considering here. It's inheritance, the inheritance relation between two classes. It's more a relation which you would have to worry about when you would like to consider whether a subclass of a class, or rather the instances of a subclass, fulfill the same kind of behavioral properties as the object of the superclass. And this is something you might like to consider independently of which kind of criticality properties you have, such as safety, security, and so on. So you don't actually need, in that sense, it's orthogonal to considering the actual safety or security requirements. It's more something more you would like to consider in which sense inheritance, for example, preserves certain properties, and it's not that a safety or security requirement would explicitly refer to inheritance between classes, because the inheritance relation actually really only exists on the specification or in the development context, and not really in the context of the running system. It's more, a mean towards putting your ideas into some order during development. So that's why I will not focus on these features of object-oriented systems so much in this context. Then, the third kind of diagram considering here is the sequence diagram, and this allows you to specify the interaction between different components or objects by exchanging messages within the system, or also again the interaction between the system and its environment. And now whenever I say component, this is in a way used interchangeably with component or object for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. And incidentally, Well, alternatively to sequence diagrams, one could also use collaboration diagrams. And these, in a way, contain the same information. So you could say they are semantically equivalent to sequence diagrams, only in a different presentation. And well, this is maybe why in this presentation I will only use sequence diagrams. But you could also use collaboration diagrams alternatively. The next kind of diagram is the state chart diagram, and this allows you to specify the dynamic behavior of a certain component in your system. And well, we will actually see the diagrams on the next couple of slides, but the state chart diagram and the activity diagrams are really rather similar. I mean, they're really based on the rather old concept of state machines. The main difference is that in activity diagrams, you specify the different components by introducing so-called swim lanes, while in state charts you only focus on one component. And then the next kind of diagram is the deployment diagram, and this allows you to specify your different the different parts of the system in the physical environment of the system. And this again is especially useful when you for example consider safety or security critical systems, because there the requirements are usually formulated relatively to the environment of the system. So if this is about loss of messages in communication between components, or about possible adversary interference in your system, this always has to refer to the physical layer of the system, which kind of communication links are used, and so on, and in which sense they are physically vulnerable. And so this is useful to have this notation, this context. And then lastly, one can use packages to group together different kinds of diagrams specifying the different views of a given part of your system. And specifically, when you do this in order to actually specify a part of the system, including the behavioral specification and all the kinds of different diagrams referring to this part of the system, then this is called more specifically a subsystem. But it's really just a package which a specific use. And yeah, so that already what I'm using in this this presentation today is the current version UML 1.5. They can also say a little bit about what kind of diagram will be new in the UML 2.0, and how to make use of that in this context. So now a bit of explanation about the different kinds of diagrams. Firstly, the activity diagram. So so how does this look like? As I said already, it really goes back on this concept of a state machine. So you have different states which you can specify, and then transitions between states. And at the states, you may have activities specified which are supposed to take place while the system is at a given state. And with the transitions, you may also specify conditions or guards which have to hold for the transition to fire. Actually, you usually draw these conditions in square brackets, which is omitted here. And then you may be able to, or you're able to specify specific kinds of states And for example, well, most importantly, this is the initial state, which is just this this dark circle. And then also you have, for example, a so-called synchronization bar. And this is where the flow of control in the activity diagram is split up between the different swim lanes, or well, between different threads of control, specifically. And well, these threads of control can then actually be distributed over different swim lanes, and these swim lanes are used to separate the states which belong to the different kinds of components or objects specified in the activity diagram. And this is what you could say is a rather high level of abstraction. Of course, there are some things if you want to actually implement this kind of this diagram or the specification, some things you have to worry about. For example, how the different threads are managed. I mean, how the different objects know that they are now in their own thread of control and they should start executing. So presumably you would have some kind of message exchange between maybe a central component or the different component. And of course, this then depends on what the overall system is supposed to be anyway, and whether it should be in an integrated system or it should be really separate components distributed over network and so on. And these are questions you may all abstract from when you draw this activity diagram, which of course is useful to be able to firstly concentrate on what is supposed to be happening rather than how it's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, the writings inside the activities, are those labels or actions?
Good question. So these in the states, you on the one hand you have internal activities, on the other hand you have entry and exit actions. And this, what I mean by this, is a good question. So it's a bit ambiguous actually. It could be taken as activities, but usually internal activities last longer and not just an assignment of values to variables, but in spirit it's probably closer to actions, although then you actions you usually write after a slash, and specifically if it should be an entry or action exit action, then you write entry or exit first. So in this example, it's not quite it's a bit ambiguous what is meant here. Actually, that's true, but this is just for yes.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Any hints about the type of activities that can be performed in each state, and which are the constraints if they are on the type of transitions for migrating from one state to another?
Mm-hmm. So generally in UML, this is really left open how to specify activities and also constraints. What the UML suggests as a possibility is to use the so-called object constraint language, OCL, but you don't actually have to use it. You could also use whatever you like. In my more specific approach here, what the formal or the mathematical foundation for this approach would support is to use for the activities, for example, use state charts again to specify an activity. That would be one possibility, or to use a sequence diagram to specify jointly the joint behavior of three of several components, which is then again coordinated using activity diagrams. And the third possibility would be since the formal model is based on this formal approach, abstract state machines, you could also directly use abstract state machine rules to specify the activities in the states. And I will say a bit more about these abstract state machines later. And essentially, that's pseudocode, which looks a bit like functional languages, although you also have assignment to variables, so it's not strictly functional. But in the flavor, it's close to that. So that you could use within this approach.
But in these states here, we just have a single letter. Are they only labels, or are they meant to be an expression?
Yes. Okay. The example actually is taken from a specific context, and there, the C and L are supposed to be labels, and in that context, they refer to state charts, which are then executed when this activity is. Why it's executed. Maybe to say this more precisely, I can try to see whether I can find this. It could be. This is one of the case studies in the end. Okay. I think this is it. Yeah, I mean here you cannot really read it, but just to just because there was this question how to specify the activities. So here you have this activity diagram which we saw on this earlier slide. And you also have a lot of other stuff. So, for example, a class diagram there, which I'm still going to explain actually, and a deployment diagram here in the bottom, and then you have three state charts here in the middle. And well, of course, you cannot read this, but one of them is labeled L, and this appears here in the activity. So this means that when this state is entered, this state chart, which is labeled L here, is executed. And similar with the other states there. So, okay. So that's the activity diagrams. Then secondly, class diagrams. So these allow you to specify the class structure of the system. So you have different classes with class names. So this each of these rectangles describe a class in the system, which may have a class name and may have attributes. You can also specify the attribute type, and you may have a list of methods or operations offered by the class, again with arguments, which may have each an argument type, and you may have a return value for which you can also specify the return type. For operations, you firstly in UML you can specify synchronous operations or so-called call operations, and these are realized then in the running system by calling another, or the object of another class, or maybe of the same class, and the object which is calling the other object is then waiting until it receives the return value from the object which was called, and then the earlier object continues to execute. And alternatively, you can also use a so-called signal, and or it's called an asynchronous message, and it's called it's written not as a call dependency, but as a signal or send dependency. And there, the situation is that the system which calls or which sends a signal to another object is allowed to keep executing itself. So these are the two basic kind of communication mechanisms which you can specify within UML. You can then draw relations between different classes, specifying, for example, how instances from the different classes are allowed to interact. And this could, for example, be by calling an operation of another class. So here, instances of the class 2 can call instances of the class 1 using this synchronous call operation. But you might also have a send dependency, also drawn using this this kind of arrow, and also in that case then having a send stereotype. So this is first example for a stereotype, namely a label in double angle brackets, and in this case it's a predefined stereotype, the call stereotype, which allows you here to specify that that you have this call dependency between the two classes. So this is really the, as I mentioned already, there are of course also ways to express information about the object-oriented features of a system within class diagrams, such as inheritance relations or associations, aggregations, and so on. But I wouldn't actually make a lot of use of those in this presentation. Although, again, you can use them together with this approach, but then, of course, you have to worry about the questions which I sort of mentioned earlier, such as whether inheritance is supposed to preserve behavioral properties or not. And that is actually, in a way, it's still a field of current research. Sometimes things like inheritance are used in a way such as the objects of the subclass can do pretty much everything they would like to do. So you can drop certain methods, you can introduce new methods, and methods can have different behavior than they have with objects of the superclass. So in a way, you might wonder, if you really want to, you can specify or you can construct an object in a subclass which is in completely different from the objects in the superclass, which is of course not what one should do, because then it's not a good way of defining the class structure. But these kind of problems I'm not actually referring to a lot in this presentation here. And then the next kind of diagram is the sequence diagram, which allows you to specify interaction between different components or between the system and its environment. And these look like the following. Firstly, you can specify the different objects or components using their names at the top of the diagram. Then under each object, you can draw a so-called lifeline. And actually, in general, this could be just a line, and meaning that the object is still waiting to be called by some other object, and then if the object becomes active, which is actually here in this example, it's active all the time, then you draw this like a rect angle. But in principle, you could have a situation where the object at times is not active but waiting to be called. Then you make specify links between the lifelines of the different objects. And this means that at each link you have a message exchange between the two objects, and you can specify the name of the message, which could be a method which is called, and you can also specify arguments to that message, which in this example again, or this specific example also from one of the later case studies, the arguments actually are more quite complicated looking, but of course generally you may not have so much information given there. You may just have a simple argument or something. This is just to demonstrate that you can actually include quite a lot of information also in these kind of diagrams. And you can also specify guards which have to be fulfilled in order for the object to proceed with the execution which is specified in the diagram. So in a way, you could view a sequence diagram as a collection of separate models for each of the object that is specified in the sequence diagram. In certain situation, it is actually important to look at it that way. So on the first view, what you see is just one diagram, and with some interaction in between. But sometimes it's necessary to separate the two kinds of objects and their behavior, and then you would look at the sort of the view of each of the objects of the system. And for example, here this would look at like the following. So the object sends a message, and then the object waits for a message of a certain which has a certain structure, namely whose operation has a certain name, namely this resp, and which has a certain number of arguments. But the point is that what the actual arguments are, of course, the receiving object does not know in advance. I mean, then it would be pointless to have this interaction to start with. And secondly, you may also not have specific, you may or may not have specific conditions about how the arguments should look like. And the point is that if you do, then you have to specify them using these guards. So this object sends a message, and then receives a message of the form resp with two arguments, and then it checks whether these two constraints are fulfilled with respect to the arguments received by this message. And what the constraints actually mean, I will explain later in the context of these actual case study. But the point is that from this point of view of this object, this is, of course, in the end, then the object sends another message to the other object. But from the point of view of the first object, this is really all that is happening. In particular, the object does not know in general whether this is actually the object as server that the object seek client is talking to. And this is important in the security area, where you're always concerned about who you're communicating with, because that's one of the, the security requirements, I will spend this in more detail, but I guess it's sort of intuitive. If you have some information that should not be leaked out to unauthorized parties, then whenever you say something to someone which contains some confidential information, then of course you have to make sure that that someone is who you really think it is. And this is, in a lot of situations, is not given as such. For example, on the internet, as it exists at present, you don't have the possibility to really know who sent you a message. This is really on all levels initially. You don't know where the IP package really comes from. You don't know who really sent you the email unless it is signed by a certain cryptographic key and so on. And that's why, when you look at sequence diagrams, you have to be aware that sometimes this looks like it contains more information than it can possibly contain. So although this looks like C is actually communicating with S, there's no way in general that C knows that it is actually S that it is communicating with. So this is just, you have to be careful with when using sequence diagrams. And then the next kind of diagram is the